You are listening to Para X. To Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, Merry Meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron here, where else, on the Para X Radio Network. Now, tonight, my opening song was called How Strange by Midnight Syndicate. And that's appropriate because we're going to be talking to author Nick Redfern about suspicious deaths, mysterious murders, and bizarre disappearances in UFO history, all documented in his latest book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. Now, Nick is the author of more than 20 best-selling books. He's a lecturer, a journalist who writes about a wide variety of unsolved mysteries. And some of his previous books include For Nobody's Eyes Only, The NASA Conspiracies, The Real Men in Black, and the Pyramids and the Pentagon. And you've also seen him on numerous television shows like the History Channel's Ancient Aliens, Monster Quest, and UFO Hunters. And I love it when he pops in for a visit. So hi, Nick, and welcome back.
Hey, Marla. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, you keep writing those books, and it keeps making me smile, and then I have to keep bringing you on. I mean, you know, it's this vicious cycle that's not so vicious.
Well, I guess, there's another one out, so imminently, or he's out. I'm not entirely sure myself, and a couple more on the drawing boards as well. So.
Oh, yeah, so you're going to keep me good and busy. I really appreciate that. As long as you continue to say, yes, come on, you know, you'll be here. I'm really, really good.
All right, cool.
Yeah. Now, you have a very tantalizing introduction to this book, where you say that while the UFO world can be illuminating, stimulating, and enlightening, at the same time, it's filled with cold-hearted killers who would not think twice about taking you out of circulation, and not all of these cold-hearted killers are human. Now, that's good. And it sets the tone perfectly for what's to come. I mean, it's got this da-da-da thing going on. So what prompted you to write about the bizarre, the mysterious, suspicious, and secret side of UFOs?
I guess the main thing is is when you're writing a book on any subject, you want to be able to give the reader something new. You know, if they're going to spend sort of $15 on a book, then you don't want to just go over old ground and kind of seen it all before. And so I always spend a lot of time trying to figure out what exactly I'm going to write about. And so I thought I went through a bunch of different things, and it occurred to me that although, you know, over the years various articles have been written about mysterious deaths in ufology, or somebody might have written about a paper about one, nobody had ever written a full-length book before on this particular subject. Now, if there'd only been like two or three cases, I could understand that, because you couldn't sort of draw it out to a full-length book. But the more I dug into it, the more I found there were literally dozens of very suspicious deaths. And it kind of amazed me that, you know, across almost sort of 70 years since 1947 with Kenneth Arnold's sighting, no one had ever written a book on that subject. So I thought, well, why not dig out some of the more well-known ones, but get as much new material to add to them, and also present to the reader all the very little-known cases as well, and in some cases totally unknown reports, and put it all out there and, you know, sort of see where it goes, so to speak.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's really kind of a neat thing, because for me, when I think about bizarre disappearances, for example, I think back to the Bermuda Triangle stories.
Yeah.
And mostly all the other UFO kind of horror stories that we've heard about dealt mainly with alien abductions, cattle mutilation, and the infamous anal probing. And now here's a book that is kind of scary. It's pretty much saying that getting too close to cosmic truths might be injurious to one's health. And you've got prime examples of that, as with the murder of author and researcher Morris Jessup in 1959. For those who may not be familiar with him, who was Morris Jessup, and what did he find out that possibly led to his demise?
Well, Morris Jessup was sort of very much like an early version of Zachariah Sitchin and Eric von Däniken. That's to say, even as far as back as the early 1950s, Jessup, who lived in Michigan, he traveled to South America, to Central America, to Mexico, investigating some of these massive ancient structures, kind of like the South American pyramids and various other structures that are set in Central America and Mexico. Mm-hmm. And he also studied, albeit from a distance, obviously, Stonehenge and the pyramids in Egypt, and came to the conclusion that these gigantic multi-ton stones could only have been moved by something like levitation or anti-gravity.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of coincided with his additional research into the UFO phenomenon in general. And he wrote a number of books in the 50s, certainly the most famous one called The Case for the UFO, which came out in the mid-50s. And he was sort of like a synthesis of all his various research. Well, Jessup at the time, you know, was sort of focused on writing other books. What he didn't know was that somebody had anonymously mailed a copy of his book, The Case for the UFO, to a special weapons division in the US Navy. And when the Navy got hold of this book, it wasn't just a regular edition of the book. What it was, somebody had bought it from a store, and they'd written all these scribblings and annotations in it, all about secret Navy experiments to try and render a warship invisible. This has become today known as the famous Philadelphia experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Navy read this, the theory is today that they recognize that somebody had uncovered information about the real Philadelphia experiment and had subsequently put all the information in this one particular edition of Jessup's book, and they wanted to know who it was. So they actually phoned up Jessup, contacted him, and said, we'd like to fly you out to Washington, D.C. We've got a copy of your book. Somebody's written all these very interesting annotations in it, and we'd like you to tell us if you know who it is. So Jessup was kind of both interested, intrigued, but also a little bit scared even that the Navy was flying him out to D.C. to talk about his book. But he went out there, and I think he was kind of expecting a little bit of a good cop, bad cop situation. But it was actually a good cop situation, where very relaxed interview, and they brought the book out and said to him, here's the book, do you recognize his handwriting? And he said, well, yeah, actually I do. And it was a guy, he said, named Carlos Allende, who had been writing to him for about a year with all this various stuff about the Philadelphia experiment and vanishing ships and sailors being killed in bizarre circumstances. Now, they thanked him, but what the Navy did, they actually printed off 25 copies of this annotated version copies of which were circulated amongst various divisions of the Navy. So they took this whole issue very seriously. Mm-hmm. Now, in the wake of this visit to D.C., Maurice Jessup had a lot of weird things go on. He would get hang-up phone calls in the middle of the night. You know, the phone goes 2 or 3 in the morning, doesn't matter where you live in the world, everybody thinks it's bad news. So he would, you know, he would get up, he would go to the phone, and it would hang up. Other times, there would be these weird electronic screeching noises down the phone and strange voices in what sounded like a foreign language that he couldn't understand, but speaking very quickly. Then he started to have mail interference, where his mail would arrive clearly torn open and resealed, but done in a way as to make it clear that he would know his mail was being opened, you know, as if to intimidate him. Mm-hmm. And he became quite paranoid at this time, which is quite understandable. Mm-hmm. But in the latter part of 1958, he then had a very weird car accident where his private notes say that he actually felt it was like someone or something had taken control of his mind and forced him to drive off the edge of the road. Mm. And he actually got seriously injured. Now, that alone was sort of, with the phone calls as well, was enough for him to worry about. But it all everything came to a head in 1959 when he actually phoned a guy, a friend of his, named Manson Valentine, and said that he'd made a major breakthrough in the UFO subject and wanted to speak to him at the earliest opportunity possible. This phone call that he made to Manson Valentine was on April the 19th, 1959. Well, unfortunately, Jessup didn't make the meeting because on the afternoon of the following day, the 20th, he was found dead in his car at the Matheson Hammock Park in Miami, Florida. And he was found by a man named John Good, who was patrolling the park and just getting ready to close it down, making sure no one was left inside. And he saw the car with the engine running, went over to it, and then saw there was like a hose pipe going from the exhaust into the car. Of course, he quickly pulled open the door and was just hit by like a wall of carbon monoxide. And Jessup was sat there, bolt upright, staring forward, just, you know, dead from carbon monoxide poisoning. Mm. Now, a lot of weird things about Jessup's death. For example, he was never autopsied. Now, just because it looked like a suicide from carbon monoxide poison didn't mean it was. You know, but no attempt was made to actually prove if he had carbon monoxide in his bloodstream or if he died earlier and was put in there. A couple of other weird things. The window of the car that was slightly wound down to allow the hose to go through had been filled with towels. Now, Mrs. Jessup, when she was contacted by the police, confirmed or stated when she saw them that they weren't the family's towels. Now, of course, no one can say for sure what goes through anyone's mind when they're going to kill themselves, I guess, but it kind of seems strange that he would go out and buy new towels instead of just taking some from the family home. Exactly. And the other weird thing was the fact that the towels were soaked in water. Now, there was a lake nearby, but that was dirty lake water. The towels had clearly been soaked with like tap water. And there was, not too far away, you know, a running tap water machine where you could get water from. The problem was there was no container or bucket or anything like that either in or around the car, so that sort of begged the question, who filled the bucket up to soak the towels to make sure that the, you know, the window was thoroughly impenetrable, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So when you've got all those issues, you know, the lack of the autopsy, the towels, the water, the lack of a bucket, the hang-up phone calls, the intimidation, the fact that he felt someone was trying to take control of his mind to make him kill himself. You know, this particular chapter, I sort of suggest or suspect, may have been a combination of murder and suicide, where possibly he'd almost had a case of like subliminal hypnosis, where that may have brought on the car accident, and maybe he was also subliminally hypnotized in some fashion to kill himself. I know that sounds extreme, but he actually did talk about how he felt his mind kept being taken over and something was guiding it. So it may have been a suicide by his own hands, but not by his own volition, so to speak. It may have been almost psychically forced on him.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about the Philadelphia experiment for just a second, too, because since it ties in, I had always heard about it and knew very little about it, but I started reading about it yesterday. And I read that some people consider it to be a hoax, and but there were very many descriptions of serious side effects for the crew members, and it kind of creeped me out because it was reported that some crew members were said to have been physically fused to the bulkheads, while others suffered from mental disorders. Some rematerialized inside out, and still others supposedly simply vanished. And it was also suggested that what you were just talking about, brainwashing, that the ship's crew may have been subjected to brainwashing in order to maintain the secrecy of the experiment. Now, while all this sounds far-fetched in general, I guess you can't rule out the possibility that things might happen like this, or did, and maybe still do. It's a scary thought.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, a lot of people have come... There are some extreme angles, I should stress, to the Philadelphia experiment story, like time-traveling seamen and, you know, sailors coming out in the 1980s and 90s and then vanishing back to the 40s and whatever. You know, there are some extreme stories like that. However, there are other stories which seem far more grounded in the sense that, yes, the military may well have been trying to make a ship invisible, and that there were some bizarre side effects, possibly psychological and even physical, on the crew. Although a lot of people suggest this was all just down to Carlos Allende, this contact of Maurice Jessop's, and a lot of people say, well, he just made it all up. That isn't the case. A number of retired Navy people have come forward, actually from the Navy itself, have come forward to say they saw film footage in the 50s of some of these 1940s experiments. And one of the guys said that the people on board the ship didn't look like they did normally. And he flatly, that was his exact words, and he flatly refused to elaborate on what he meant by that. Mm-hmm. And there's also a story of some secret files on the case having turned up at a naval yard in Cyprus, of all places.
Cyprus?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so there's a lot of weird angles to the Philadelphia experiment. And I do think there's enough data to suggest something happened, and that it was hidden, and that there were adverse effects on the crew. And I kind of take the idea that some of the aspects of the story are more plausible. You know, I find it a little bit far-fetched, the sort of traveling through time and having adventures in the 80s and 90s and new lives and then going back again, which is more like the Philadelphia Experiment movie, which is quite a good movie. But I do think there could well be something to the idea of optical camouflage and that it went wrong and had an effect on the crew.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just, you know, I'm starting to read this thing about crew being turned inside out and stuff, and that just kind of went, whoa, okay. That's worse than any Harry Potter thing gone bad, you know? So it was just kind of amusing and scary at the same time. Now, I briefly mentioned animal mutilation a little while ago, because there's stories have sprung up all over the place, but you also discuss human mutilation and the grisly story about what happened in Cambodia during the Vietnam War. Now, that was freaky, yet apparently not uncommon at the time, or years later when mortuaries were being somehow pilfered, correct?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I guess, one of the more sinister sides of the UFO subject. And when people ask me, why do I think the UFO subject is being covered up, I think one of the reasons is because of the more disturbing and sort of rogue aspects of the subject. And I think the whole subject gets covered up because, you know, it's impossible to hide the whole thing. You know, it's like the old saying, you can't be a little bit pregnant, you know. It's kind of like the same thing here, that if the floodgates were opened up, everything is eventually going to come out. And I think there are certain things that certain people don't want coming out, so it all gets clamped down on. But in saying that, yeah, human mutilations, I think, are one of the main reasons why there is a cover-up. You know, there's probably not really any easy way for any agency or elected person to say, not only aliens here, but they're abducting us, but we suspect they've killed and mutilated people for weird biological experiments. I mean, that would cause uproar. You know, that would cause uproar. But yeah, the story that you're mentioning, that I talk about in the book, actually came from a guy named Leonard Stringfield, who spent a lot of time digging into the UFO subject and writing about it. But he was also in the US 5th Air Force in military intelligence. And as a result, he sort of cultivated a lot of contacts within the military and the intelligence community. And one of them was a high-ranking military officer that Stringfield actually knew personally, not just as a colleague or a source, but as a friend. And he vowed never to reveal his name in his lifetime, which he didn't. The story goes back to April 72, when there was this experience or incident that occurred in Cambodia during the Vietnam War. And the story was that a team of U.S. Army military personnel, kind of like a Delta Force team, had been sent out to assassinate a North Vietnamese unit that was involved in, like, covert ops. Well, they got to where they thought, at least, was the location in question, not to find the North Vietnamese troops, but to find this pretty large sort of circular globe-like object standing on tripod legs. And all around it were these creatures, clearly what we would call aliens, like skinny, large heads, big eyes, but not sort of the little three-foot-tall greys, about 5 to 5 feet, 5 tall, something like that. Mm-hmm. And they were reportedly loading human corpses and body parts into these large bins, kind of like meat packers in a factory, that sort of thing, and then loading them aboard the UFO. And, of course, the Delta Force-type team, I mean, those guys are sort of primed and trained, but even they sort of froze, apparently, because it was just something they weren't anticipating or ever expecting, I guess. But the story was there was a firefight, and a couple of the aliens were killed by headshots, and some of the Delta Force people were injured quite badly, and they were forced to retreat, and then the UFO took off, but not before loading all these bins on board the craft. Mm-hmm. Now, the story from there went that everybody was debriefed by a group of guys in suits, and they were also supposedly given sort of what may have happened with Maurice Jessup, like a hypnotic or post-hypnotic insertion, if you like, to try and make them forget what happened with it by inserting a cover story. Some of the guys sort of came out of it years later or would have dreams about it and realize what had happened, and then one of them spoke to Leonard Stringfield, and yeah, I also talk about other ones in the book where morgues and mortuaries have been raided in the middle of the night, almost under like impossible fashion, where no one could get in at all under normal circumstances, and eyeballs were removed and lips and tongues. And there's actually a very similar story to that from 1979 in between Bliss and Jerome in Idaho, where a pair of hunters came across a man's body, where, again, both lips were removed, one ear, and the sex organs. And, you know, it clearly wasn't the work of a mountain lion or a bear. It was like somebody had systematically, or something, had systematically dissected the man, for want of a better term.
And picked choice parts.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, kind of, in many cases, like with the cattle mutilations, where, again, it's very often the tongue, the eyes, and the sex organs that are taken. So in that sense, there's sort of a parallel going on there as well.
It is, and it's really kind of amazing. Now, you know, there have been a lot of journalists who have ended up dead after delving into these types of cases, and it's not very clear whether they were murdered by our government or extraterrestrials or what, but as I was reading along and seeing so many cover-ups along the way, there must be some connection and perhaps an arrangement between our world and those that are out there in space, in their world. And, I mean, they're probably good guys who we may very well have an understanding with, and bad guys, just like we have, that nobody has any control over. But personally, do you believe that our government is in contact with and has dealings with extraterrestrials on some level?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting question. The first thing I would say is I would qualify it by when you refer to the U.S. government. I mean, people have asked me, you know, do I think the U.S. government is killing UFO researchers? No, I actually don't. What I think, and I truly do believe this, I don't believe that the U.S. government at all are the guilty parties in this. What I think is that the real deep UFO secrets and these assassinations are handled by what we might call like a shadow agency, like a rogue group, that exists mm-hmm. outside of the official infrastructure, if you like. Kind okay. of like the palace in the Men in Black movies, where the Men in Black don't work for the government. They work for an agency that's outside of government, and mm-hmm. you know, the CIA, the FBI don't even know who they are. And I actually right. think that's something that is probably the real situation. I don't think the Air Force, the CIA, the government, anybody like that is killing anyone. But mm-hmm. But I think there is like a, almost, that's what it is called, almost like a modern day worldwide Illuminati, where you've got powerful figures, big money people mixed in with huge technological corporations, where I think, where I suspect a lot of the UFO technology has been farmed out for them to research rather than it being done by government agencies. I think there's good evidence that going back to sort of the 60s, all of this went out of government hands into sort of very deeply buried private sector organizations and agencies. And so we have like a, like I said, almost like a, an agency or an organization, something like the Illuminati, where, you know, big money, ancient families, big worldwide influence, but they're a law to themselves. They are like a rogue mm-hmm. government. So I mm-hmm. think they're the ones who are involved. And I think, yes, they could well but have some sort of contact, whether sporadic or ongoing, with these entities. And I think there's probably some sort of uneasy connection between the two, you know. But I don't think this is happening sort of at the Pentagon or the CIA. I think, you know, right. there could be people listening to this show right now in CIA headquarters saying, yeah, we don't know what happened at Roswell, but it's ironic that everybody thinks we do, you know. but that's what I really think, that it is yeah. outside the loop of government.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes good sense. But here's the thing, as you're talking now, this pops into my head, that it's been written that President Kennedy, you know, while serving in Congress, knew all about UFO crashes and the recovery of alien bodies. Sorry. And because he was a former naval intelligence officer, he was deemed a reliable person to receive such highly classified information. And then, as you say in the book, sometimes around 1961 or 62, when he was in the White House, he expressed a wish to see the alien bodies associated with an alien crash site, and I'm guessing that would be Roswell, could be wrong, but because he had information, or obviously been informed of their existence and wanted to see the evidence, they actually brought bodies to Florida for him to see at a medical facility. And then, it says he demanded to see the UFO papers like 10 days before his death. Now, apparently, in what I read, he wanted to make things known to the public, and the next thing you know, he was assassinated. Now, why would, let's go on the theory that this is a different governing body that deals with ETs and everything else, as you said, like Men in Black. Why would there be a reason for them to perhaps kill him, or even our government, if this is in fact what he was planning to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think all of this is actually done by a rogue agency, because the very fact that the president would have to try and find out for himself what's going on, you know, mm-hmm. that suggests it is outside of the government. You know, who's True. Higher than the president? If it was in government, if all this is being done by the government, which I said I don't think it is, then the government would know. But the government are the ones saying, well, who's hiding this, you know? That's, mm-hmm, that's why it gets into, like, really strange areas and concepts to get your head around. But, yeah, the story is that when Kennedy was elected, somebody basically said, you know, Mr. President, there are certain things we've got to tell you, and a lot of it was sort of just regular stuff with the Russians or the Cubans, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But then he got a UFO briefing and told that, you know, it's essentially out of the hands of most people and but we can give you a briefing. And as you said, there are sort of rumors and stories that he may have been taken or was taken to a military base to see a certain amount of sort of UFO wreckage and a number of bodies. Now, the story is that in itself wasn't the issue, because we also have stories of previous presidents like Eisenhower and Truman specifically, mm-hmm. supposedly being led on the truth, but they weren't assassinated. But the story is that Kennedy didn't just want it kept inside, so to speak. he wanted to do two things. He wanted to share it with the general public because he felt it was too much of an important issue to hide. But also, he was worried that if the Soviets found out that we had alien technology, they might panic that they would fall behind in the Cold War and they would launch a sneak nuclear attack on the US and it would result, you know, in just worldwide destruction. Mm-hmm. And so his idea was to share it with the Soviets to keep a balance of power where both sides would know that neither side could win. And the story is that whatever this rogue agency is, that was just too much for them. You know, one thing to tell the public, another thing to share the technology with the Russians. So the story is that the countdown was then on to having taken out of circulation. Now, although that sounds to a lot of people, I'm sure, like sci-fi, the fact is the more we look into the whole Kennedy assassination, the more we find numerous sort of strands and tangents that link the assassination to the UFO subject. For example, going back to 1947, a guy named Fred Chrisman, who was heavily involved with the intelligence community in 47 and also handled wreckage from a reported UFO crash in a place called Maury Island in Tacoma, in Washington State, excuse me. He turned up in the Kennedy assassination. In fact, Jim Garrison, who's played by Kevin Costner in the JFK movie, Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, actually came to believe that Chrisman was one of the gunmen at Dealey Plaza. On top of that, former FBI agent Guy Bannister, who was known to Fred Chrisman. Back in 47, Guy Bannister was heavily involved in carrying out UFO investigations for the FBI when he was still an acting serving agent. And he's played in JFK 2 by Ed Asner. And the day before Kennedy was shot, when he was already in Texas, he took a trip to Brooks Air Force Base in Texas, and he opened a new medical wing. This was a wing that was essentially devoted to space medicine, as it was called. Bearing in mind, this was the early years of the space race. Nobody really knew what effect long-term exposure to low gravity and no gravity and, you know, the outside the ozone layer and things like that, what effect it would have on people. So that was the idea of this new wing, was to sort of study how the human body could be affected, like blood pressure and pulse and your organs if you're in a totally gravity-free environment. Mm-hmm. Now, when he was at Brooks Air Force Base, Kennedy had a behind-closed-doors meeting with a man named Major General Theodore Bedwell. Now, Bedwell, in the summer of 1947, was stationed at Wright Field, as it was known at the time, in Dayton, Ohio. Well, it so happens that at the same time that Bedwell was stationed there, and he held a major medical position, this is the same time frame and the same base when the bodies from Roswell were supposedly taken to Wright Field. And he would have been one of the prime people to show the bodies to. Mm-hmm. And here we have him one day before he was shot speaking to Kennedy behind closed doors on matters relative to space medicine and possibly even his time at Wright Field when the bodies were taken there. And then less than 24 hours later, he's dead. But the strands go on and on. For example, Senator Richard Russell, one of the members of the Warren Commission that looked into Kennedy's death. Senator Russell was the one member who thought there could well have been a conspiracy behind Kennedy's death. Now, he had an investigator working for him who just happened to be Colonel Philip Corso, who wrote the book The Day After Roswell. On top of that, Russell himself had a major UFO sighting in the Soviet Union in 55 when he was visiting Russia on a fact-finding mission. And it was such a profound encounter to him. He actually got a behind-closed-doors meeting with the CIA who briefed him on the UFO subject. So we got like a Warren Commission connection to the UFO subject there. And the strands like that, they just go on and on and on. There's so many, and it's sort of a very weird thing to imagine possibly that I argue with two of the world's biggest conspiracies ever, UFOs and the JFK assassination, may actually be part of the very same thing.
Mm-hmm. It would seem so. I mean, as you said, it's like an octopus. All the feelers are out there and everything is connected to something else. Now, I have two questions from the chat room. And the First one is from Sherry, and she wants to know, to ask you about Bob Lazar.
Bob who?
Lazar, sorry.
Yeah.
I think she just wants to know what you know about his death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Lazar isn't dead, but somebody did try to shoot him once. But Lazar was a scientist who, briefly in late 1988 through early 89, was employed at Area 51. And in 89, he went public with his story about how he was brought on board to back engineer and try and understand the technology behind a number of UFOs that somebody had acquired and was keeping at the storing at the base. Now, this may well have been where Kennedy was taken, because Area 51 was around in the 50s, never mind the 60s. Some people think that's where Kennedy had this briefing and was shown these battered little bodies in, you know, in formaldehyde or whatever, and essentially told, well, we've got these bodies and craft, but we don't really know what they are, where they're from, what they want. All we know is they crashed and we've got them, you know. And Lazar said that even as late as 1989, very little research or successful work had been done. And this kind of goes back to this rogue government thing, because one of the reasons was that they didn't want to bring in mainstream, well-known scientists who probably could have pushed the project further ahead very quickly, but they were worried that bringing in names, so to speak, those people would be unable to resist telling the world that, you know, I was the guy brought in to investigate the aliens. And so they brought in maverick-type people like Lazar. And again, it sounds like a rogue agency where, you know, the average government employee or even person in the military or the intelligence community had no idea of what was going on at this particular installation at Area 51. Again, it was like a rogue group, but sitting, you know, in a notable location, a verifiable location, but nobody other than the people who had real access had any idea what was going on. And Lazar has stood by his story ever since that, yes, I saw these craft. But when he went public, he did get a lot of threats, and somebody actually tried to shoot out the tire of his car. But he wasn't sure if that was, you know, a hitman who just missed his target, or if it was deliberately meant to hit the tire to really try and frighten him, you know, about saying anything else. But he dropped out the UFO subject after a while, but he still stands by his story today if questioned. But so it's a very sort of fascinating story, really.
And he's still alive and well to tell the tale. Yeah.
Well, so the thing is, what he did, he said that when he told his story first and hardly anybody knew about it, his bosses at Area 51 went crazy, and they told him to come back to the base. And that was when he thought, well, if I go back now after I've told a few people, what if I'm never going to get out again? And hardly anybody knows, and something could happen to me. That was his way of thinking. So that's why he went totally public. He felt, if I go totally public, and I'm totally in the public domain, and everybody knows, they won't touch me. And that probably makes a lot of sense. He was really concerned when nobody did know, and he did feel that his life was in potential danger, and that's why he felt he just had to go totally public and nobody would touch him then. And I think there is a lot of sort of merit and common sense to that idea.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the second question we have from Chad is from Ceiling Cat, and she wonders if you think that the Hadron Collider Project will increase UFO activity just as the A-bomb tests did?
That's actually a really good question, because throughout history, you know, when we've been engaged in sort of advanced technologies and weapons and things like that, there has been an increase in UFO activity. And, the Hadron Collider, I mean, that could sort of really, you know, play a role in this. And, I mean, if you go back to the 40s and 50s, atomic energy research places like Oak Ridge in Tennessee, there was a massive wave of UFO activity at Oak Ridge that ran from something like 49 to about 51. And, I mean, we're talking about major UFO encounters. In the mid-70s, there were a lot of stories about U.S. military bases being flown over by UFOs, and reportedly the UFOs actually scrambled the launch codes of the missiles in the nuclear silos underground to where they couldn't be launched, and they had to be sort of reprogrammed as if somebody was pointing out that, hey, you know, we can disable your atomic weapons anytime. And I think this is actually, the question is a very good one, because it demonstrates that we may be prevented from actually doing something. You know, if somebody does the unthinkable, presses the red button, somebody may intervene and actually stop it from, you know, erupting any further than that. You know, if our missile silos can be disabled, if electrical systems can be shut down, on the one hand, it's sort of comforting that we might be actually be literally prevented from having a nuclear war, which would be good. But on the other hand, if these entities are so powerful they can shut down everything, that could also work against us. You know, and I think maybe there's a monitoring of our technology to see how quickly and accurately or whatever it's proceeded, and maybe certain things that we're creating or building or technology-wise, somebody might not like them, like atomic weapons. You know, maybe they're just putting that sign out that, hey, you know, we can turn it off at a flick of a switch or whatever.
It's such a fascinating subject. I mean, on all different aspects of it. Now, there's so many cases discussed in your book that go back a way long time, you know, back, as you said, into the 40s. And every decade that follows has something else kind of going along with it. What about today, 2014? Are stories like this still surfacing?
Well, certainly not as much as they were certainly through the 90s. You know, the number of events that have actually occurred in the last couple of years is rather interestingly, you know, a lot smaller. But there have been some weird deaths. Now, I don't actually talk about these in the book, but some people have made a UFO connection with some of the deaths. There was a flurry of deaths in the field of microbiology. This is people who research lethal viruses and, you know, spontaneous eruptions of bizarre diseases and exotic viruses, and even manufactured viruses or mutated viruses. And between 2001 and 2005, I mean, there were literally dozens of scientists. I mean, they were dropping like flies left, right, and centre all around the world. Like, weird suicides, jumping off bridges, car accidents, heart attack, strokes, all out of the blue. And some of the aircraft crashes, and literally some of them just like days apart. I mean, not even weeks or months, just days. Now, some people have made the point that there are admittedly a lot of stories within the UFO subject that at a number of UFO crash sites, some of the recovery teams have reportedly been killed by when they've seen the dead alien bodies, and perhaps the bodies have been, you know, ripped open or whatever, and the quick reaction team have been on site, they've been exposed to like a lethal virus that's killed them very quickly. I actually have a chapter on one of these cases in the book in Mexico in 74, where the recovery team was supposedly affected and killed quickly by some sort of alien virus. So coming back to these microbiologist deaths, there is a theory that they were working to develop like the ultimate bioweapon, which would be derived from an alien virus. You know, there are even darker theories that it could be what are called race-profiled viruses, you know, to target certain races or types of people. And one of the theories is that somebody was wiping out the microbiologists after they'd completed their work, or somebody else was trying to wipe them out before they had a chance to complete the work. So that's but if you Google sort of microbiologist deaths, I mean, or scientist deaths, I mean, there are still a few weird ones going on now, but 2001 to 2006, I mean, it was just like, you know, somebody was just going from one place to another and taking them out one at a time and then moving on to the next and the next and the next.
Wow. And there are patterns that form all along in this way too, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the stories collectively from like 47 to now, you see a number of deaths, or certain circumstances that keep cropping up. One is people jumping out of high windows where there's like an official secrecy angle surrounding them. Strange car accidents where the person didn't know why the car crashed, like Maurice Jessop. And I also talk about some deaths of English scientists, worked for a company called Marconi in the 1980s, where a number of those scientists felt something was controlling their mind, forcing them to sort of drive off the road. So many who killed themselves by, you know, just carbon monoxide in the garage, you know, just drive the car into the garage, shut the door, and kill themselves. Others jumped off bridges, suicides, bizarre suicides. So, yeah, you've got, it's not just you've got a trend of deaths. It's a trend where there's just, where there's sort of certain key ways these people supposedly killed themselves, but clearly when you look at it, actually weren't suicides at all.
Now, this may be an odd question, but probably not. But personally, do you think that aliens live among us and perhaps are in some top government positions? And,
Well, I'm not, I think, you know, I'd like to see some harder evidence about the whole issue of government positions. But what I would say is that there are a lot of stories, and I've come across a lot of these, of sort of people amongst us that, you know, could kind of pass for human at a glance or at a distance, or if it's late at night, you know, they've got a hat on or whatever. But see them up close and they look weird. I mean, a classic example of this is the Men in Black. You know, it's one of my big interests. I've written several books. I've got another one coming out shortly on this subject. But with the Men in Black, you know, they have this sort of, they're not like the movies, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. They're sort of usually 5 foot to 5 foot five tall, very pale, emaciated looking, skin looks anemic, and like sometimes have these bulging eyes. But, you know, with fedora hats on, as many of them wear, and sunglasses, and often just coming out at night, you could kind of pass them in the street. You might not notice too much. So in other words, this has given rise to a very disturbing theory, the idea that aliens are creating like human-type hybrids, or they're biologically creating something like a robot. Not like we think of robots, we think of like metallic, jerky things. But if you talk about the idea of genetically creating a robot, which is but one born out of or made out of flesh and blood, but like a grown, if you like a grown entity that is sort of part human, part alien, designed to infiltrate us without us knowing by trying to make them look as much like us as possible. I have to say, although it sounds extreme, I have a lot of stories like that where people have said, you know, they've been contacted or watched, and they feel that there's almost like an underground silent army getting bigger and bigger of these things. Now, I'm not saying it's on all, the whole subject's negative, because it clearly isn't, but it's like on Earth, you know, there are people, good people, and the people you want to stay away from. And I think it's the same here, that there could be different agendas. But, you know, it's kind of like with the black-eyed children. That's the most recent aspect of all this, these sort of creepy little kids who knock on people's doors at night, and, you know, they've got these totally black eyes, always dressed in hoodies. They look like little vampires almost. And they're like the latest part of this whole controversy of creatures, if you like, the best way to describe them, that look like us but don't as well. And, you know, it's a very, very weird and disturbing aspect of it.
It reminds me of Doctor Who episodes, actually. You know, sometimes I wonder, you know, if anybody follows Doctor Who, that some of those things are so plausible when you see it like that, and you kind of think, hey, why not, you know? And they have this, there was that one episode about everybody, the Prime Minister in England and all the people there were reptiles, you know, but they were in human suits, and then they unzip themselves and poof, they're out. But I mean, you know, as interesting and funny as that was, sometimes you wonder, why not?
Well, I think there are a few politicians out there I think we could justifiably call reptiles, whether they actually are or not. There's more than a few around the planet.
Yeah, that's very true.
They act like reptiles sometimes.
The reptilians, the greys, and you know, all the other, you know, grab, put them all together. But it is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I do think, as I said, certainly with the Men in Black and stuff like that, I think it's highly plausible. We're dealing with something that has deliberately made itself look as human as possible to infiltrate us. But as I said, you know, the stuff about the Queen of England being a blood-drinking reptile, I really don't go along with that at all. But, you know, but people do, you know. It's a free will. They're entitled to research it.
It's amusing, but, you know, I mean, it's always like one of these things where there's smoke, there's fire somewhere, a little bit, tiny bit. So you just never know. You know, I mean, we don't know. There's so much that we don't know that it's hard to decide about anything anymore, because either people don't care, people don't listen, people aren't allowed to find out. It runs the gamut. So it's kind of amazing that anybody can really surmise anything. And
well, one of the problems I see is that, you know, it's a lot of the time, today in today's world, I don't think it's often so much that the information is suppressed. It's just that society has become so dumbed down. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's worried about who's going to get voted off this show next week or whatever, you know. And that's sort of taken over. And not, you know, how often do you see, you don't see kids playing outside anymore. You know, all they're doing is text, where are you? Oh, I'm at Walmart getting a box of cornflakes, you know. That's it. It's kind of scary to think of what's the next generation going to be, and the one after that, brought up by kids who, you know, don't go outside and play on the, right, you know, when I was a kid, I'd ride my bike, fall off, and I'd scratch my legs to pieces, and my dad would say, you idiot, you know, and today, you'd have like the social services around demanding to know why you let your child ride a bike at 6 o'clock at night. But, and I think that's an overall thing in society, that society is becoming dumbed down and told it's not safe to do this, it's not safe to do that. And so people just become very sort of self-focused, you know, in their little home and don't really look at or listen to what's going on the outside. I'm not generalizing everybody's like that. Of course they're not, but it's certainly it's a growing number, and it should hopefully be a lessening number.
Yeah, technology has turned into a babysitter, the great babysitter, as opposed to the great outdoors. Yeah, it's scary.
I think people who can't, you know, they can't stay off Facebook for 10 minutes. I'm like, you know, go out, have a life, you know, go out with your friends, go to a football game or go down the pub or whatever, you know, just don't keep counting how many friends you've got on this page or that site or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, you can't pick up a phone and call. You have to text. All right, that's another
thing. I don't get that at all.
Yeah, I don't either, and I will jump up and down talking about it, so we're not going to do that now. One more very quick thing we want to talk about is you've got, as you said, a new Men in Black book coming out, but you also have a book on zombies. Yes.
Well, yeah, it's got the stunningly original title of The Zombie Book.
Clever.
It didn't take long for somebody to work that one out. The book was actually due to come out in September, but occasionally I'll write a book and for whatever reason it comes out early. And so it's actually come out this week. And it's one I wrote with Brad Steiger. And it's about 450 pages long. It's like an A to Z of everything to do with zombies in movies, TV shows, novels, but also like folklore, history, mythology. So because it's A to Z, it's got like, you know, V's for voodoo or virus, A's for Armageddon or apocalypse, kind of that kind of thing. And so I think there's about 250 entries, each about 1,000 words, where people can get a background on everything from, like, for example, how the Vikings believed in zombies, and the Chinese, they had their own equivalents of zombies and things like that. And the Chinese stories, going back 2,000 years, like really weird, where they actually believed people would come back to life and bite other people, and then they would die of a mysterious disease and come back. It's just like literally like today's zombies. But these are Chinese zombies 2,000 years ago. And they gave them this name that in English translates as like click, click, because they would make this weird clicky movement when they were sort of jerkily walking along. And it sounds just like, you know, something you'd see on The Walking Dead today. But I like zombie stuff, so I was pleased when the publisher said, we want to run a zombie book for you. So.
Exactly. So where can people find your books? Because the new Men in Black book probably will be out in the fall, no doubt.
Where can people find your books? Well, people can get all the books on Amazon, and the new book and anything published by New Page Books, which is about another 10 of my books. They're all available off the shelves in Barnes & Noble, and the zombie book also Amazon or Barnes & Noble as well. So.
And what's your website in case people want to dig up about you?
People can reach me at nickredfernfortean, which is FORTEAN, nickredfernfortean.blogspot.com, or type Nick Redfern into Facebook. There are about 8 of us. We're not all clones. If you scroll down, you'll see me. And I'm always, you know, always pleased to chat with people. If people want to share information or if they've got questions or just want to hang out and chat, you know, I'm always happy to do that.
Yeah, you're one of the good guys, Nick. You are.
Well, I try to be, but there's always a bit of a bad guy in me as well, which isn't a bad thing. You know, it keeps life interesting. So.
That's part of your charm, too. It works both ways. Well, thank you so much, so much, so much for coming out. And I will be in touch down the line about maybe the new Men in Black book, because that is a fascinating subject. And I want to also thank everybody for listening in tonight. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Thanks, Mama.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Martha Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2013. Moonlight Hall by Kevin MacLeod, licensed through Incompetech.com.